Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy.
You're going to consider pardoning even those who pleaded guilty to crimes, including assaulting police officers.
Well, sometimes they say, here's your choice.
You're not ruling it out.
Look, I know the system. The system's a very corrupt system. They say to a guy, you're going to go to jail for 2 years or for 30 years. And these guys are looking, their whole lives have been destroyed. For 2 years, they've been destroyed. But the system is a very nasty system.
Okay. Let's
move on. Yeah, I'm going to look at everything. We're going to look at individual
Everyone.
Cases, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm going to be acting very quickly.
Within your first 100 days, first day?
First day.
There we go, Hackaroos. That is President-elect Donald Trump talking about the jailbirds of J6. By the way, I think J6 and the jailbirds would have been, and you coined that, Johnny Heilman, would have been a great moniker for an early 60s rock band. I think that is the right ring to it.
And if you had Screaming Jay Hawkins as the lead singer,
exactly.
John Anzalone, our guest today, as the lead singer, you know, John Anzalone and the Screaming J6 Jailbirds, that's a band I would go see.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, maybe wearing three-cornered hats. Move in on Paul Revere and the Raiders a little. Yes, Johnny Anzalone, pollster to the stars, a god in our field, good Democrat, and your single greatest credential. You, like I, are Michiganders.
That's
from
right.
The great Wolverine state. So we've got so much to talk about. I think we've got to start with the 60, excuse me, what am I saying? The Meet the Press interview.
Well, that's what we just played. For anybody who didn't realize what that was, it's gotten a lot of airtime. That was Donald Trump. I mean, I was at that thing, Murphy, in Waco when he really kicked off the campaign. And that was like, the first time I had ever seen the J6 choir. And you're at Waco and Trump is playing a convict choir in the place of the national anthem. And I thought, man, is there anybody outside the base who wants to vote for somebody who's like talking about pardoning people who beat police officers with flagpoles? apparently
a lot of them.
Apparently, like, well, it's a thing to get into, but I got to say, like, of all the things I find inexplicable, that is one of the ones that I most find inexplicable, because it used to be that it would be unelectable. You'd be unelectable in America if you were like, I'm on the side of people who beat cops with flagpoles. Like, you know. That's the one I can't understand. A lot of Trump's indiscretions and crazinesses and the people tolerate them, I understand why they do. But that's the one that I don't get. Like, hey, let's free the people who beat the cops.
Yeah, it's not as important as the price of eggs.
Well, I know that. But
I think people think it was done. Yeah, people went to jail. It's over. On to the next thing, fire Biden. But John, you talked to, through Insight Research, your polling company, your partners, you pester tens of thousands of Americans with polling phone calls. You listen to the pulse. What's your take on that? Why didn't that issue have more traction?
Listen, first, just in terms of, I mean, if you're, you know, Susie Wiles and you know, Chris LaCivita and Tony Fabrizio and all the James Blair, all these talented people who just won an election, like, you're hoping your boss can get off that, right? I mean, you're hoping that, I mean, it's different than 2016, 17, but it isn't. In some ways, there's an America and you know, even some Dems who just hope that he sticks to transactional issues and gets things done. And there's some things that you can do in a bipartisan way. And clearly, his staff do the big eye roll because they tried to backtrack on some of that stuff as well. His spokesman did. You know, they're hoping that he's talking about, you know, cutting the deficit or energy policy or, you know, permitting or crypto regulation, anything, right? Anything that can, stemming the flow of immigrants, et cetera, and so, you know, they hope he gets off this type of stuff because it doesn't do him any good.
But it didn't seem to do him much harm. You know, it resonated with some folks.
Yeah, but here's the thing is, they weren't elevating this in paid communication in the campaign. I think that's the case. I think the Democrats had trouble trying to figure out how to engage a PTSD about Donald Trump. That's a different topic. You know, whether it was January 6th, whether it was the criminal indictments, whether it was his behavior, whether it was whatever. That's a difficult thing to do. I'm not being critical. You know, I think they had time to figure it out, but I don't think that in any way this kind of balance, if you will. Hey, his word cloud was fix the economy versus all the bad behavior that he brought to the table and the anxiety that he brought to people when he was actually president. And they picked, we lived with it.
Let me just ask a question. This is like the future forward part of the podcast here. So I understand all of that. That part I get. But let's just think about what's about to happen. If Trump actually does what he just said, if he goes and starts letting people who are insurrectionist convicts out of jail on day one, forget about paid media. We're now in the world where he's president of the United States, and there's going to be wall-to-wall free media, earned media, whatever you want to call it. It's going to be a massive story. First day in his second term, Donald Trump frees the J6 jailbirds.
And people will be opposed to it.
That's my question. My question is, what are the public opinion? I get if we look at an issue like that and say, this is an issue that's not very popular, but they don't amplify it, and people have PTSD, so it doesn't have much salience. I get that, that political dynamic. But it's going to be elevated in an extraordinary way if Trump makes good on that promise. What does that do to him in terms of public opinion dynamics, if that is really the centerpiece of what he does on day one?
Yeah, I think there's something like 60% of Americans would be against this, pardoning these people. 60% were for, people who did this type of activity, serving jail time. And again, it just takes away from his core economic message, which he should be doing every day. And he should learn from the Biden administration that you got to go and do that right and make sure that the American people see it as a priority every day, right? And everything else is just taking you off your game.
The question to me is, will things ever kind of revert to political mean as far as the laws of gravity? Trump has perfected the politics of the primal scream. People were mad, 70% wrong track. They wanted to fire Biden. Price of eggs, all the kind of pain factors. And he just threw a bomb every day. It was undisciplined. Half the process coverage of the campaign was, his staff are worried he won't get on message. And we've all come up in normal politics where all that stuff's really important. Instead, he just did the yowling, and it worked like a charm for him. He got a ton of votes.
But can we just unpack that for a second, Mike? I think that he was undisciplined to the opinion elites, right?
No, I agree with this.
But his campaign, I watched these guys. I was a spectator in the 2024 election. My partner, Molly Murphy and Matt Hogan, did some of the Harris polling, and we're proud of that. But I was just a spectator. And their campaign, meaning transactionally what you do in those seven battleground states in paid media and messaging, was incredibly disciplined.
Yeah, no, that was the only thing they could control because they couldn't control Trump. So, we're going to hammer her on I'm not different than Biden.
Yeah, and we get all excited about him making some, remark about Puerto Ricans or whatever, and it doesn't mean anything.
Well, no, but here, this was my windup to a bigger pitch.
Okay.
My point is Trump does Trump. Trump's Trumpiness plays a lot better than the media elite thinks because there's a big bunch of frustration in America of all the liberal stuff culturally and every other thing. So now he's going to come in as president, to Johnny's point. And day one is going to be the J6 jailbirds. But I think there'll be 20 things on day one and day two and day three. It'll be the same blitz he's trying to do of cabinet appointments.
Right.
Flood the zone. Flood the zone with bullshit, as Steve Bannon famously said.
Right. So there'll be an avalanche. But here, Trump's a guy who was elected in the 70% wrong track to shake up Washington and make things like they were when he was president economically for the average voter, who has fond memories of that time, not thinking about J6, thinking about their car payment or whatever it is. So his expectations are sky high. So for a while, I think waving the bloody shirt will work because people hate Washington and they love to see Trump punish it. They don't like the lefty stuff that much. But then after 100 days of that, dysfunctional cabinet, silly feuds, incompetent people running around. Meanwhile, the world is getting much more complicated at a rapid speed. Syria, Korea. What does Trump say? I think it's going to be the bumpiest 100 days ever. And there'll be a lot of pearl clutching by the media elite. Oh my God, he wore the wrong kind of shoes to the United Nations. But in a wider way, people have huge expectations that Magic Man is going to come in and fix politics now and, make cost of living less and prices will go down. And none of that's going to happen. Instead, we're going to have a war on dreamers. We're going to have, him talking about jailing Mary Cheney like he did on Meet the Press. I don't know. I think Liz Cheney. Mary's an old friend of mine. So my larger point is the razzle dazzle wall of bullshit thing that worked so well to an angry electorate during the campaign. Now he's the guy who actually has to be responsible for running stuff and will be held accountable like Biden was. So I don't know. I think this thing could have a shorter half-life than people are assuming.
Well, I mean, I think that's the $64 million question, right? We know the expectations are high because, again, literally his word cloud as a candidate was he'll fix the economy. So every day that he's not doing something about that, he he's off message. And he has, or quite frankly, deportations and immigration, et cetera. But again, he can have small successes. I mean, who the hell knows? I mean, if he just concentrates on what, if he, says that the administration says it, on the criminals and felons, et cetera, et cetera. That's his focus. And he's not, sending people back who've been here for 17 years or is small businessmen from, Allentown, right? And part of the community. Then he can have a certain success and a facade on something like the border. The economy is a little differently, but what I think we have learned about what people like about him is his strength. So him threatening China and Mexico and Canada.
Yeah, the posturing terrorists will play, at least in the short term.
Will absolutely play. And I think the one thing that really could play, is cutting the deficit, right? His election wasn't about reforming politics. That was the first one. Now everyone kind of understand he's just about, he's a political animal. But the thing that he has, which we haven't had in a long time, is authenticity. I mean, that still goes a long way in politics.
Oh, yeah. No, he's very transparent about everything awful about him, which is both effective and deeply troubling. But how does he's not a fiscal conservative. That's the reason a lot of us old school conservatives don't like him. He's a blank check, whatever you want.
I heard John Anzalone just say something about deficit reduction. Maybe deficit reduction would be popular. Does anybody on this podcast right now think there's a chance in hell that Donald Trump's going to preside over a significant or any deficit reduction? No.
But he's going to talk about it, and there's going to be hearings, and there's going to be there potentially could be some residual positive on that. And quite frankly, listen, I grew up. You want to talk about Michigan? I'm going to go way back, Mike Murphy, Howard Wolby. Do you remember how Howard Wolby?
Oh yeah, I do. Jimmy Margolis, right?
Yes, Jim Margolis was the chief of staff, and Howard Wolby got famous because he got a discharge position, a petition or whatever they call it, to kill the super collider in Texas, which was billions of dollars.
Right, boondoggle.
It was the superconducting super collider. If you
thank you, I appreciate that. Yeah. But my point is that it doesn't take much.
You're saying symbolically, Elon will say, I found 1,800 limousines for bureaucrats. Fine. It's my old sell the state helicopter trick from Michigan.
Can I just inject a dose of just level setting on this, right? Trump went through 4 years as president, never was above 50% in his approval rating ever. He was really actually never above about 46. Retroactively, in the course of this campaign, he got north of 50 for just barely nosed over it. However, and again, I take nothing away from the victory that he won. I mean, it was thorough. It's not overwhelming. It wasn't a landslide. The guy ended up a little south of 50 in terms of the popular vote. Beat Harris by a point and a half or whatever. We're talking about all these things. These things are very popular, and he really resonates. And I'm like, he resonates. He's not a... Is there a world where we imagine Donald Trump is at 56, 54, 53? I mean, even in the high 40s, or do you imagine the next 4 years where Trump is where he was the first 4 years, bumping along between 43 and 45? And that's fine, but it's not like Barack Obama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton at their peaks where they're, it's not none of those guys.
I actually think Biden's numbers are instructive because he ended the campaign in 2020 with a 54% favorable rating. I think his highest job rating was in the early honeymoon stages before inflation kicked in was 58. The one thing that I think is important on, again, the expectations level, which I don't think he'll meet, but the fact is that his retrospective job rating was always hovering right there around 51%, which I always believed was you know, his ceiling. People kept saying, oh, he's hit his ceiling at 47. No, he, you know, your ceiling is your job rating. But the but his job rating, John, with on the economy was in the mid to high 50s. And so that's kind of potentially.
Well, that's the golden memory that was the rocket fuel for holding their nose and voting for him.
So, I mean, you, did you see the conference board today? For example, the conference, like CEOs are all ecstatic, right?
Yeah. Yes. Hey. They like tax cuts and deregulation. Great, let's go.
Where do we get tariffs?
But if CEOs are looking to the future, are more optimistic, you know, that plays into their plans for their companies, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So again, can Trump fuck it all up by putting a 25% tariff and people understand how tariffs work? Yeah.
Maybe your answer is this is going to be deficit reduction, but if you think back to the beginning of the first Trump term, he came in and there was still this moment. When he first came in, there was this moment where he wasn't really a Republican. He wasn't really a Democrat. He was associated with most people as being a name that they thought of as a builder. His name was on buildings and he was a tycoon, right? I always thought that that moment, if he had, and I, there was some commentary about this at the time, but if Trump had come in and said $1 trillion infrastructure package, it would have been, he could have been a juggernaut. If like every Democrat would have had to support a giant, I'm going to rebuild America. A $1 trillion infrastructure program. Democrats all would have voted for it as a big jobs program.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree, but it's not the world Trump operates.
No, I understand, Mike, but my question to both of you guys is if you were now sitting here, fully 4 years later and you had Trump's ear and you said, listen, I know this isn't your instinct, but if you really want to be a juggernaut, if you really want to prove everybody that you're different and that you could be a colossus because you have on this wave of good feeling, this is what you should do. Here's a popular thing you could do that would really feel like that Democrats would have to vote for, that would just shock the shit out of people because no one expects it from you, and it would be a giant winner. What would that be?
Well, it's what I, you know, I'm sure at some point we'll talk about resetting for Democrats. It's the things that the Democrats should be doing, right?
Is there a bill? Is there a proposal?
Let me outline a few of those things, because again, I think the difficult thing when you're in this, you know, cost of living is a problem. Now he gets in some ways a pass, because I don't think people believe that prices are going to go down. They just don't want them to go up. They're going to give him some, you know, acrobatic pass on this. But there's things that you could do. For example, medical debt. The Democrats did student debt. Well, guess what? Just imagine if they had done medical debt, which we hear about all the time in focus groups, right? People are all about erasing medical debt, you know, things like home health care so seniors can stay in their homes, things like childcare, which we've never ever fixed, et cetera, et cetera. I actually think that these little transactional things could be really big things. And we've forgotten in politics to take a look at those type of things that send signals to people that were on your side. And they're non-traditional things for Republicans. I hope Democrats also do them and start talking about them. And I think that housing is another thing. And he knows housing. But, you know, Democrats are going to have to make a really interesting decision in the House and the Senate. Is that, yes, there's a certain resistance when he does outrageous and stupid things. But you know what? They're also in the triple minority. And there's some benefit to finding the things that you can do in a bipartisan way to actually maybe get things done.
Yeah, yeah, but it's all through the looking glass. I mean, I agree, you do a build-up American plan, et cetera. It's not Trump. Trump's going to pick a million grievance fights, and it's going to cloud the message, and it's going to burn the clock, and the old memories of Trump, which was better economy, are going to be supplanted by new memories, which is fighting, and who knows what will happen abroad. So I agree there's a blueprint, but you know, every time you give Trump a smart blueprint, he rolls it up and tries to stab somebody in the eye.
Yeah, I get it. And we don't know whether we're dealing with the old Trump, which is just going to be the old Trump, or the old, there's going to be a new Trump. But the fact is that you look at, hold on, or worse Trump. But you look at someone like Thune, and you kind of have to be impressed initially that this guy has a package for the first quarter and second quarter of 2025. And I think that he's a transactional guy, right? And, you know, I always find that interesting, too, because I think one of the ways that people underestimated the Biden administration was, you know, there was Steve Ricchetti and the legislative people doing all this hard work, getting important legislative stuff passed, while other stuff is going on in the podium of the presidency, right? And it'll be interesting to see whether Thune can, you know, kind of get the Trump White House and the House kind of focused that, hey, we got to do these things, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. Thune was a vote for normalcy. Thank God it was a secret ballot to pick the Senate leader. God knows it would have been Don Jr. You got to also remember the House is a two-vote margin, it looks like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that means no margin, and that means very limited grip there. That first place it could fall apart.
Did Don Jr. get elected to the Senate recently? Did I miss that?
No, no. Trump would have just declared martial law.
No, I just declared it.
Okay. Yeah, that's how you MAGA. Come on. You got to start thinking like the new reality.
I'm sorry, Mike. I'm sorry.
Let's stop for a minute and listen to a word from one of our fine sponsors.
Hey, everybody. John Heilman here. Newsflash. This podcast, Hacks on Tap, is sponsored by The Washington Post. If you listen to Hacks on Tap, you almost certainly care about what's going on in the world. If you don't care about what's going on in the world, I have no idea why you care about politics. And if you didn't care about politics, I don't know why you'd be listening to Hacks on Tap. Obviously, you care about politics and you care about the world. And listening to us is a great way to understand a certain element of the world from a certain vantage point. But if you want to get even more greater, broader, wider, deeper coverage of our crazy world, you really ought to subscribe to The Washington Post. When you go to thewashingtonpost.com/hacks, H-A-C-K-S, washingtonpost.com/hacks, our listeners, you can get an exclusive deal to subscribe to The Post for just 50 cents a week for your first year. Last time that I read The Washington Post, that was about 10 minutes ago, getting ready to do an interview with a very important person in the National Democratic Party, one of its leaders, and there's a story about that guy in The Washington Post just now. I read it, and man, was it good. I can't tell you who it was, but because I don't want to give away my secrets of how I prep for doing interviews, but I got to tell you, there's never a time when I'm interviewing a politician or a major public figure, someone in public policy, someone in the campaign game, when I don't go and search the Washington Post to see what's been written about that person, because the reporters of the Post are fantastic, and they know things that even I don't know. It's hard to believe. That's, you know, one of the many things about the Post that resonates with me. The other thing is, not only the reporters are great on stuff that I'm pretty au fait with, they're also, they got great critics. They got great sports writers. They got all kinds of great stuff going on in the Post. It's a really, really fantastically written paper, and it has the feel of our nation's capital always imprinted on it in a really deep and indelible way. Washington Post app makes it easy for me to stay up to date with the latest news, especially political news. Makes it easy for me to save and share stories and follow my favorite reporters and other writers. The Washington Post even offers a cool feature for audio lovers like you. You can actually listen to the articles in addition to reading them, or instead of reading them, so you can tackle your to-do list and catch up on the news at the very same time. So now, more than ever, it is vital to stay up to date on the world. So go to thewashingtonpost.com/hacks to subscribe for just 50 cents per week. That's 4 bits per week, shave and a haircut for your first year. That's 80% off the Washington Post typical author. So this is truly a steal, and a steal that you will not want to stop. Ha, ha, ha. Once again, that's thewashingtonpost.com/hacks to subscribe for just 50 cents, just 50 cents every week for your first year.
Hey, let's pivot to the Democrats.
Well, wait. Let me get one last question in before we do that. I want to do one last Trump question, all right? Mike, I want to ask you in particular here, okay? So, because we've been spending, you know, everybody's been spending a lot of time on these crazy cabinet picks, and rather than like getting in the weeds on each one, I just want to ask you this question, right? You know, the Pete Hegseth drama rolls on. We got Kash Patel's in the chute. Here's the next big controversy to come down the pike. You've got a Bobby Kennedy Jr. In fact, let's just play one more piece of sound here. I want to play this. Here's Trump on Meet the Press talking about Bobby Kennedy, his nominee for Robert F. Kennedy Jr., about his nominee for Health and Human Services Secretary, where Kristen Welker asks him about the vaccine, but the fact that Kennedy's anti-vax, and what does Trump think about that? Listen to what he has to say.
Let me ask you about RFK Jr. He has obviously talked about his skepticism of vaccines. He's expressed opposition to childhood vaccines. Do you want to see childhood vaccines eliminated?
If they're dangerous for the children, look.
So possibly?
When you look at some of the problems, when you look at what's going on with disease and sickness in our country, something's wrong.
Are you talking about autism?
Well, if you take a look at autism, you go back 25 years, autism was almost non-existent. It was, you know, 1 out of 100,000. And now it's close to 1 out of 100.
Well,
I mean, what's happening?
I mean, okay, so but beyond the lies and factual inaccuracies in that whole thing, it's just an illustration, right? He's RFK Jr. is Health and Human Services Secretary is a ludicrous and dangerous proposition. Can you imagine anybody worse if there was another pandemic that you'd wanted the head of HHS? No. But Mike, my question for you is, it's more Trump chaos. Every one of these guys and gals who's been nominated is, a lot of them are creating huge controversy, and other administrations, they would be, you know, they would consume, they'd be scandalous to the point that they would inflict huge damage on the president-elect. Does any of that stick to Trump, or is this just like reality TV at this point? Everyone's like, well, here comes the Trump crazy, you know?
Well, I think over time it does, because in the smart version of the Trump verse, you're sitting around the room saying, all right, nice con job. We convinced everybody happy days are here again with me. We need some killers in these agencies to deliver things, or over time we're going to boil in the same wrong track that killed Biden. But what he's doing instead is a seat of the pants, pick buddies, and Fox green room regulars. So I've gone into disaster triage mode as a, you know, card-carrying deep state elitist here. Member of the old Republican Party, where we like smart people in charge. Hegseth is having a little comeback. I don't know what will happen. He's obviously a terrible nominee, but he'll do limited damage. The uniformed military in the Pentagon, I've worked there as a consultant, they will eat him for lunch. They will give him a plane and tell him to fly around and inspect, you know, aircraft carriers, and he'll be very busy, and he'll let the building run wild. Not good for Trump. Not great for America, but his damage ability is limited and he won't last long. Tulsi Gabbard is terrifying, but on the other hand, DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, was layered over CIA years ago, wasn't popular. So the mandarins of the CIA will do what they love to do, which is never sharing information. They barely give out anything now. This will be an excuse to hold it on. They're probably happy. So damage, but somewhat controllable. RFK, on the other hand, can get into the real machinery. And this is one place where there's actually a huge, powerful political lobbying group with great grip on the Republican Senate that's horrified, which is the pharma industry. Because this guy, he'll have some power in there to really screw up. Now, maybe some people argue, well, if he paralyzes it and the bureaucrats and the professional science people are there all in revolt, you know, it'll sleep a little and that we can survive that. But I mean, he has crank ideas, and he's infecting Trump with them. The other two that are really scary is, you guys know, Kash Patel, who's high on the score for bananas, and also the FBI is a place that is powerful and important, and you'd hate to corrupt that culture because it'll take decades to clean it up. That's terrifying. And then this guy voted OMB. You know, nobody knows what OMB is. Well, OMB stands for Really Damn Powerful Agency that reaches everywhere. And that really could be the Trump shock collar to do a lot of disruptive things in the administration. And he is not dumb, this vote guy, and he knows how to play that piano. So, you know, you wonder, I think a lot of them are going to get through. So I see it as now a damage control scenario.
John, what do you think about this? I mean, so much of the political physics has been turned on its head in the last, you know, 20 years of our careers. You know,
listen, I think that the congressional hearings are going to be, you know, with these nominees are going to be fascinating, right? And they're going to lead the news, and it's not going to be a good look. I think that when you take a look overall, you know, Bobby Kennedy has the potential to impact negatively more real people in America than any of these nominees, including kind of just the misinformation, right? Yeah. Because they do put doubt in people's minds about, yeah, oh my God, should I get my kindergartner vaccines? And that's a really a big thing. Not to mention all the other agencies that he touches.
Come for the measles. Come for the measles. Stay for the smallpox. Yeah.
Exactly. Welcome to the Middle Ages.
Yeah, yeah. But do I think that real Americans worry about, you know, the defense secretary or NDI and all that type of stuff? Probably not. They probably think that there's other people who are going to be checks and balances on them. But I just think what's going to be exposed here in the congressional hearings is going to be, you know, just really bad TV for them. If they're, again, at the same time, they're not doing stuff on economics to kind of step over it.
All right. Let's pivot. Let's pivot to these Democrats.
Do that. Let's go, Mikey. Get in there.
Well, let's get into the future. Now, first of all, I'll do my little quick rant. We've had two post-election things, and I feel sorry for the Biden people. They worked really hard. 70%, excuse me, the Biden Harris people.
Yeah.
70% wrong track means the country can hardly wait to hit the ejector seat. So, shocker, they lost. I thought it was a good, not great campaign. There were mistakes. Thought they bungled Michigan. But they had to then do the walk of shame. First, it was our friends over at Pod Save America, a podcast talking about what happened. Then they had to go up for the Harvard thing. And I'm glad Harvard does that. I'm a former IOP fellow.
Yeah, I was there. It's a really important event.
It really is. On the other hand, it's kind of a bit of a rigged deal. Because I know for a fact that some of the people in the last week who are now saying we knew all along, we're like, God, you know, if they'd only listened to me, we screwed up. So it's an opportunity for the winners to get more credit than they deserve and the losers to get beat up a little more than they deserve. But there's been a bit of a grassroots Democratic howl on both events that there wasn't enough contrition and the leadership of the campaign didn't do what I have to say I think would have been proper, which is we clearly screwed some stuff up. We should have done Rogan. We should have pushed the candidate to do it. You know, ooh, we missed an event in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. No. It there are places where I think they could admit mistakes and it would let some of the air out. And, you know, so anyway, that's my take on it. I'd say move on to where the party goes. But the some of the knuckle wrapping, I think, for not fessing up to the fact that when you lose, there got to be mistakes. You got to fess them up. I can go on for, an hour about some of the mistakes I've made on campaigns that didn't make it. But what do you guys think? John, you're the hard-edged journalist, and Anzo, you've been in the hot seat.
No, listen, I don't think there's anything to add to what you just said. It's like when you lose a campaign, there's going to be things that you would have done different. When you're sitting in that hot seat as in a very public place like Harvard, I was in the audience, I was watching it. It's just hard. Like, you feel bad for them, and but have your list of things that you probably would have done differently in retrospect. I think that's important. And if you're on the winning side, don't try to gloat too much. And I thought that,
Fabrizio tried to control himself, I thought, because Tony was
fantastic. He's a good friend. We co-founded the Wall Street Journal poll together. We do all the AARP.
Yeah, I've known him a long time.
He does. Listen, Chris LaCivita, who's like the Marine, and, Tony would occasionally say, ho down, but I thought all in all, they took pot shots. Chris LaCivita's first pot shot was at DeSantis, who did not send anyone. So, it wasn't just all beaten up on.
But look here, the reality is this, the way more people are going to be exposed to the Pfeiffer Positive America thing, the IOP, which I also love. I'm a Kennedy School graduate myself. I'm a fan of that. I went to the first one I ever went to was the 88 one, which was kind of an incredible thing because Susan Estrus almost killed Roger Ailes in that event. I was like about Fair 22. Fight. I was about 22 and I was like, holy shit. So I love that event, but really it impacts almost no one because it's not broadcast anywhere and et cetera. But the PodSafe thing was heard by a lot of people, and a lot of Democrats listened to that podcast. And Anzo, here's my question. Is just we can then talk about like really how, like, what do we make of the whole election for the whole Democratic Party? But in this one specific area, Plouffe and Jen and others made the point accurately and repeatedly that the degree of drag on the Harris campaign, they had very little time and they had a lot of environmental drag. You know, the, as Mike talked about before, the wrong track number, the questions around the economy, all that kind of stuff. Fit totally fair, right? The question at the, and this is a tricky question to ask you given some of your history, but I'm going to ask it anyway, just as a pure tactician. The thing where I thought they did not have an answer that was, and maybe they didn't have an answer because they didn't want to say anything negative about Harris here, was where Dan tried to get them to say, if Joe Biden's approval rating and the wrong track number were such a huge fucking problem, did you not need to create more distance between yourself and Joe Biden, meaning Harris, create more distance between herself and Joe Biden? And I thought their answers on that were, were they kind of danced her. Well, she didn't really want to say these things, and there was a lot of hemming and hawing around the question of, and if we'd done that, there would have been a lot of relitigation in the press over whether she really had a different position. I listened to that and thought, you're basically telling me the core strategic problem with the campaign, the challenge you had to overcome, was a 70% on-track number and you're the vice president to a sitting president with an approval rating in the high 30s. And your answer to the, okay, well, what did you do about that? Well, there wasn't really much we could do, is not just an adequate answer. You could say our candidate was just unalterably opposed, but nobody took it on. So I guess I'm asking you whether you think they needed to do more. And if they did, could they have?
Yeah, they needed to. Could they have?
Yes.
Well, but here's the thing. For what end? At the end of the day, we've all been involved, Mike and I, in a lot of campaigns, and we're loyal people. You know, I met Joe Biden and did my first Biden for president when I was 22 years old. I'm going to be loyal to the guy to the very end. And the fact is that they're coming off a campaign and they're 2 weeks out of it.
I'm talking about the Harris campaign.
Kamala Harris under the bus. And I respect that, right? The fact is that, you know, it was her decision on The View to say that there was not like that, right? She created that herself. And there could have been a million different ways that you answer that question. And so I don't think it was incumbent upon the staffers or the advisors it's incumbent upon the candidate. And it didn't work out that way. But I don't fault David Plouffe or General Mailey Dillon or Stephanie Cutter from, like, you know, throwing Kamala Harris under the bus 2 weeks after.
Okay, wait, yeah. John, don't misunderstand my question. I'm not attacking those guys for being. Yeah. I'm saying it was not a satisfying answer to what I actually want to know, which is not, I don't care how they perform on these postmortems. What I would like to understand better is what the dynamics were. If that was the central thing, what were the dynamics actually going on in the campaign that prevented her from doing it? Was it purely prevented her from doing what she needed to do? And my question to you is more kind of like, not how did they perform? How did they perform? Talk about it later in the campaign itself. How would you have solved for that riddle? It's hard. You're the vice president to the sitting president. In addition to your loyalty, it's hard to create distance in that situation. What would you do?
I think they had a really good August and September, right? And part of the success there and what her word clouds were when people were getting to know her, interestingly, were things like she was a prosecutor, right? She was attorney general. She was taking on big fights. And I think that that's how you do the distance, right? I mean, she had a very short period to become her own person. And I think the Trump campaign did a brilliant job of bringing her back in. If you saw the Bidenomics ad and hitting her on the inflation and things like that, hitting her on the border czar stuff, et cetera. So I think one of the things that Molly Murphy had said, who's my brilliant partner, who was part of the polling team, was, again, saying what you might have done a little differently is probably elevated her biography, because, you know, you know, 107 days to get her known, to get her agenda out there, make a contrast, and project herself in responses is a really hard thing to do.
Well, she was still wearing lead overshoes, though. I mean, let me ask you guys one more backward question. And then we can talk about future of the party for the rest of our time.
Mike, what's your answer to that question? If you had been advising Kamala Harris and you said, hey, we have a big Joe Biden incumbency problem. We got to do something here. It's got to be dramatic, but obviously we don't want to shit on our boss, the guy who made us vice president, put us in this position. What would you have advised her to do?
Oh, I would have done the break. I mean, my main advice, look, I went to a secret meeting I can't really talk about right after the disastrous debate. General Mailey Dillon was there. A lot of the anti-Trump Republicans were there at their invitation. And I made a run there. Look, the Biden was down to 50% favorable or 52% in LA County before this debate. Biden's dead. He can't win. You're going to have to do a switch sooner the better. And it can't be Harris, because that's just Biden all over again. And at that point, I said, I think she's a terrible candidate. Now, she was a better candidate than I expected, not better enough to do the insurmountable thing. And, you know, Jen, to her credit, good, loyal staffer, smart person, came back strong at me. It would have to be Harris, though. You know, they were at that point, they were arguing a little bit that Biden is stronger, but not really. I mean, they weren't saying anything bad about the vice president. But the idea of doing a big switch with a mini primary that would have, there would have been less than 107 days, but somebody would have won and been a winner, which is a defining cue that Harris never had. But as far as what I would have done in their situation, other than drink heavily, I would have done the break. I would have said, as vice president, I'm the loyal supporter. I'm proud of this president. We have the best domestic policy, you know, achievements. Here they are, bing, bang, bing, CHIPS Act, blah, blah, blah. But as a candidate, it has to be my own vision. And so I'm going to build on this foundation. But yeah, of course, there'd be differences. And bing, bang, bing. I would have done it because I think they were doomed otherwise. It's just, this often happens in campaign. John Anzo knows this.
Yeah, I know.
The thing you have to do is so tactically painful. You're like, well, not today. And then eventually it's never, because you got to cut off your hand to win. And you're like, well, there's got to be another way. So you struggle with little things to try to survive squaring an impossible circle. And, you know, I get it. It's so hard to do. And I get it that it's much easier to talk about than do. But tactically trying to improve Biden. I mean, look, I fell for the sauce near the end. I saw the vibe difference. Yeah. And I thought, you know what? She, in a changed election, she's so different than Trump. Maybe that'll work for her. But the fundamentals of this thing were doomed from day one with her.
Okay, gentlemen, we will be back in a minute, but we have to pay a few bills.
Hey, everybody, John Heilman here with some words from the sponsor of this episode, BetterHelp. It's Christmas time, the holiday season, whatever you celebrate, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whatever. It's that time of year. And I don't know about you, but I love the holidays. Holidays are like, there's a lot of Scrooges out there who say they don't like the holidays. I say to them, bah humbug. Holidays are awesome. So many things to love. Chestnuts roasting on open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by choirs. And even some really adorable people dressed up like Eskimos. Also my dog. You put the roaring fire, the chestnuts, and a really nice, big, excellent, well-aged bourbon in my hand. You get all that together. You know, that is Christmas for me. And it's awesome. It couldn't be better. And then it's over. Suddenly, as soon as it arrives, it's out the door. And now you're in January. And it's just cold and brutal and vicious. And all the magic is gone. Here's the thing about therapy. Therapy, unlike Christmas, is always there. It's a way to bring yourself some comfort that never goes away, even when the season changes. Holidays go away, therapy sticks around. And along with therapy, all the great things that therapy brings, including that kind of comfort, that coziness, that warmth, that security, that sense of self-knowledge, that sense of inner peace, all the stuff that, you know, a little Jack Frost nipping at your nose stuff from the holiday season. And so honestly, if you're thinking about starting therapy, you really ought to give BetterHelp a try because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient and flexible and suited to your schedule. All you got to do is fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you don't like the first one, you'll try a second. And if you don't like the second, you'll try a third. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So find comfort, find coziness, find warmth, find serenity this December with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/hacks today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp, HELP.com/hacks. This is still backward looking, but kind of getting towards more towards forward looking. We have the election on election night. You know, it looks like, you know, they got all those red arrows pointing across in all the counties. And there's all these kind of scare statistics about Trump's gains and the demographic and the certain demographic groups and in the counties and all that stuff. Right. And everybody's like, wow, man, Trump really walled the Democrats. And then all the votes come in, you know, over time. And it turns out that, you know, Democrats picked up a seat in the House and they lost the Senate candidates in the battleground states, other than Casey, you know, overperformed Harris. They held on to, they won most of those seats. You know, there's this counter argument, John, that has kind of come up now, which is at first it was, man, we are fucked. We lost again to Donald Trump. We really need to do root and branch reform of this party. We're out of touch with working class voters. We're out of touch with black men. We're out of touch with Hispanics. We have these existential problems. And now there's another point of view in the party, which is sort of like, hey, this wasn't a good election for us, but party wise, we didn't do that bad. I mean, it's not a disaster. It's not like what we saw the Democratic Party in 80, 84, and 88, where they lost three consecutive presidential elections by crushing blows, where the presidential candidates were in the 400 electoral vote region. And there's a lot of Democrats who are now like, you know what? We had inflation. We got caught. The president got caught in a worldwide anti-inflation, anti-incumbent whirlwind. He got out too late. Harris never had time to catch up. We'll retake the House in 2026 and be off to the races. I'm not advocating that point of view. I'm saying that is, there's an ascendant view among some in the party that that this other view of root and branch reform was hyperbolic. So where do you come down on what ails the Democrats and how bad is
it? So I come somewhere in the middle, because I think it's prudent to, you know, go and figure out why we're losing so many young people, right? Young males, young African-Americans, clearly Hispanics. And when everyone but seniors recede, then you better go and do an autopsy and figure out whether, okay, was it just the short time span with this candidate versus what we have available to us in the future? So I think that's really important. At the same time, just a little bit on your, I don't know if it's your side of it, to put things in kind of a reality, you know, again, this pains me to say it because I'm a Biden guy, but if we had not had Harris, let's think this through, and she hadn't brought the base back, right, to where a level setting, again, when President Biden was in the race, he was losing nationally to Trump by 4 or 5 points. And at the end of the day, you know, even the polls were dead even or whatever. If President Biden was the nominee, we very likely lose Alyssa Slotkin, Tammy Baldwin.
Yeah.
Nevada. I'm blanking. Jackie Rosen.
Yeah.
And probably Gallego, considering the margin. So
yeah.
Let's you know, give Harris some credit for, again, the level setting of literally bringing back to levels that we needed to kind of reset the race, even though we lost at the very end. But the fact is that we receded vote that we have to figure out. And is that because of they made her unacceptable on a bunch of economic, border, and social issues? And can our future, which we have a great bench, I mean, we've all been in this business a long time, but when I look at what's happening in the states, and we're having such success with governors and a lot of senators, that's important. But when I take a look at who might run for president in 2028, you have Whitmer and Cooper and Shapiro and Wes Moore and Warnock and Pritzker and Phil Murphy and Booker and Warner and Newsom and Buttigieg and Landrieu. We have a hell of a bench. And most of those are moderate Democrats who will not, you know, be able to be branded like Harris was branded. And I think, and again, that's not being critical of her.
Yeah,
she didn't have a choice. Like, she was going to be the nominee, right? And so, you know, the fact is that she ran for president in 19, you know, to the left of a lot of people in that race. And so she was exposed. A lot of the people that I just mentioned aren't exposed.
Right.
No, the bench is a good point.
The bench is a good one. And what's happening in states, whether it's Wisconsin with Evers, you know, or in Michigan with Whitmer or in Cooper, and now Stein's going to be taken over in North Carolina. Warnock in Georgia is a superstar. Wes Moore in Maryland is a superstar.
Yeah, yeah.
You can go on and on. And so
let me be the contrarian, though. I'm going to push back a little on this.
By all means.
It's Michigan. You know,
do it, Mikey. I want you to make the case for why MTG, Gates, Vance, Donald Trump Jr., and Tucker Carlson is a stronger bench to the Republicans than the bench that adds. I know, I'm being sarcastic.
Oh, I won't make that case. No. That's the problem. No. Here's my thing, though. And I get it could have been worse than how Harris did, the Slotkin race. And so Slotkin ran a better Michigan race than Harris did by a mile. The bigger point I'd make is just the internal psychology of the politics that, well, it could have been worse, not so bad. No. You don't build a winning party with participation trophy thinking. They lost. They've lost their national appeal. They can't get arrested with working class white guys. The Latinos move so much that we've never seen a shift like this in modern American politics. They used to be a 30-point lead party with Latinos. They went in with an identity argument, and they got killed by an economic argument, and they seem to have some doubt about that. I'm listening to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party say, well, this is great. We lost working class people. Seize the means of production. We know how to get them. Go farther to the left. I mean, the Dems really need to understand
that. But that's not the real
these problems. Let me finish up, and then you can riddle it with holes. They need to understand they're losing, and the internal incentives of the Democratic Party to define the whole thing on identity strangles them out of the box and gives demagogues like Trump an easy route out. And what worries me the most, and I'll finish with this, is the midterm should be good for the Democrats. And if they do a lot of dumb things and win for free, which they could, it'll reinforce all the wrong thinking. Instead, it's time for people in the party who know the center path where they can get back in business with white dudes and Latino working people, validated by a midterm win, is the way to set the frame for the primary with all those talented candidates that Enzo's talking about.
Listen, I agree with you, and I started answering John's question by saying we receded with every subgroup, and so we have to figure out how to do it. Right?
Yeah, and there's a message there. Yeah, to Trump, by the way, we ran, you know, clown.
Your theory here, or how you would move forward, is what we did in 18. Right? 18, we showed again. We took back the House with moderates all across the country.
And meat and potato economic issues, not identity.
Nancy Pelosi has been elected in 6 and 18 by having a really strong group of moderate Democrats in her caucus. And we took back states like, you know, Whitmer, who is, you know, ran as a moderate, Sisolak ran as a moderate, et cetera, et cetera. I can go all the way down the line. And we, you know, we have that equation. We have to figure out in the Democratic Party how to be able to have conversations about really tricky issues like transgender, you know, college sports, without, you know, the person who sticks their head out of the foxhole like Seth Moulton getting his ass kicked. Like, we should be able to have this reasonable conversation.
Yeah, totally.
This is the problem with our party, right? That Republicans don't often have, is that we have a big tent and we get scared. We literally get scared of having conversations about really tricky issues because we're going to get our asses kicked by a super minority part of it.
Right. And it gridlocks your campaign. We got to do 20 focus groups and get 80 people in the discussion. We can't respond to a trans ad. We're going to argue. No. You need less democracy inside the Democratic Party and an agreement to move forward on this stuff and fight.
Yeah. I spent the last 30 years living in Montgomery, Alabama. When I started my firm in 1994, you know, from then until when, you know, we took back the House, I was helping elect people's like Bobby Bright and Charlie Milan's, right? Childers in Mississippi. And, you know, all of these guys at the time were pro-life, pro-gun, anti-gay marriage. Do you think that Nancy Pelosi gave two shits
that those people,
she wanted to become Speaker? And I think we have to get back to the part where, listen, I don't want my candidates to be pro-life and pro, you know, anti-gay marriage. Don't get me wrong. That was a different time. My point is that we got to give people space to understand their own electorate and, you know, that they may take issues that gives part of our party agita. But if you ever want to be in the fucking my majority again,
exactly,
you better deal with it.
Time to pay the meter, but we will be right back. Now, let's hear from our sponsor. Hey, Hackaroos, you know what? Isn't it funny how the people we love most are often the hardest to shop for? People always tell me, Murphy, you're impossible to shop for. We're just going to give you a tie. Well, I never wear ties, so I give them a hint. I'm a gadget nut, and let me tell you, on behalf of just about anybody in your life, but particularly people who like cool stuff, even if they're not that technical, there's one gift that everyone on your list is sure to enjoy, an Aura digital picture frame. Now, this thing has been named number one by Wirecutter, and they're tough reviewers. What are they? Well, Aura frames are a lot of fun. What they do is they make it incredibly easy to share unlimited photos and videos directly from your phone to one of these cool picture frame things. So it's kind of like having a picture frame on your shelf, But the photos can change because you can upload them from your phone. And again, as I said, even videos are possible. So when you give somebody an AuraFrame as a gift, you can personalize it and preload it with a thoughtful message and photos using the Aura app, making it the ideal present for long-distance loved ones. It's a gift so special, they use it every day. Now, you know, the perfect gift is hard to find because it has to be personal but not over the top. When you give an Aura picture frame, it's a way of sharing memories. Maybe your families have been on vacation together, or it's a favorite grandson or granddaughter doing something interesting, or a collection of photos like that. It's a great connecting device. It's a family-oriented gift, and it's technically really easy. You don't have to work at the Jet Propulsion Lab to figure out how to do this. You just use your phone, the Aura app, bingo bango. It's all automatic to the actual picture frame. It's designed to do a lot of the work for you, and then give that joy to people who will see those pictures every day and treasure the Aura picture frame. So how do you get one? That's what I want to know. Enough of this talk, Murphy. Get to the call to action. You can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com, A-U-R-A, frames, one word, .com, to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver mat frames by using the magic promo code HACKS at checkout. That's AURAFrames.com, promo code HACKS. This deal is exclusive to listeners, so get yours now in time for the holidays. You got to get going. Terms and conditions do apply. Check out the Aura frame. I've seen them. They're very cool. I'll never forget, as a young consultant, I got a call hauled in to see Bob Dole, the great, late, great, fantastic Bob Dole. And he said, you know, I'm going to send you out to do this Senate race nobody wants because we got to drag this guy back. And I said, well, you know, the guy's not that sharp. And he's like, Mark, don't need the guy, need the vote.
That's exactly right.
And that's exactly right. And when I went out and we got him reelected, and Dole got his damn vote, you know, that's the way politics work. I don't need the guy, I need the vote.
Do you think in 1988, when we were doing Frank Lautenberg's reelect, any of us were in love with Frank Lautenberg? He was a curmudgeon. Yeah, no, exactly. We were all working for James Carville. That was the win. We wanted the Democratic vote. You know,
totally. All right, go ahead, Johnny.
To your point, John, is like, you know, the one of the challenges with the Democratic Party is about this is not, it's not quite. I just frame it a little bit differently, just in this sense. And 2018 is a great example. The three of us know that what you just said is true, that the way the Democrats performed in the 2018 midterms, the way they did, was on the back of moderates and the Mikey Sherrills of the world and the Alyssa Slotkins of the world. But here's what the public saw was the squad. And I'm not even trashing the squad. That's not a shot at the squad. It was the election of that, where the headlines were around AOC and around Ilhan Omar and around Rashida Tlaib. They were the ones who drew the media attention. They were the ones who actually, in a lot of people's minds, defined the party as having become way more progressive. And in fact, their ascendance set the stage for all of the fucking mistakes that Harris made in the 2019 phase. The perception that the party had become way more liberal or more progressive than it actually is what totally fucked up a lot of people's campaigns, frankly, in the 2020 nomination contest. And so the thing I'm pointing to is not actually to critique anyone in this, but just to say that one of the challenges of a big tent party is that when the Democratic coalition is working, there is room, in fact, and there should be room in the Democratic Party for pro-life Democrats. There has to be. If you're going to be a national majority, you got to have room for that. But the reality of how we now consume politics is that people don't pay attention to. I respect Mikey Sherrill to death, but for a long period of time, Rashida Tlaib gets a lot more ink and becomes the symbol of the Democratic Party. And contending with that, how do you align what the party really is in toto?
Purge.
With the image that it gives off is one of the challenges. And it's weird because Republicans have that same challenge. You know, the Republican Party actually isn't Marjorie Taylor Greene, but somehow it doesn't fuck them up in quite the same way as it does the Democratic Party.
John, you just made the greatest argument for every political consultant, staffer, and elected official to get off social media. because it's a trap.
No, no, it's true. You get your own brand, it's bad for the collective.
It's absolutely a trap. I mean, we have elected officials now who just obsess over, you know, again, we got to get to the point where we're not afraid of our own shadows. Right now, we're not only afraid of our own shadows, but the other is like, you know, we're walking on eggshells because we don't want to piss off this part of the party or that part of the party or that part of the party. And the fact is that you need to get elected. And if you look at the really talented politicians who are authentic and do their own thing, people like Gretchen Whitmer, you got to say, like, she connects with working class people and she connects with suburbanites in Oakland County, but she can go up to, you know, Traverse City or Upper Peninsula and also have a beer. And so you just got to be your own your own person.
Well, you know the great old saying, authenticity. If you can fake that, you got it made.
Yeah, that's good.
All right. On that note, we're going to skip the mailbag because we have a hard out today for a variety of reasons. But
Mike, you were talking earlier about all that, about how you could go on at great length about some of your failures in campaigns. And I think that's why we have to get to the hard out now, because aren't you doing one of your My Failure seminars? They're like in LA, they're like a cult following. People show up to listen to Mike self-flagellate.
It's true. I drive there in my Bentley that I bought with win bonuses. All right, I don't own a Bentley. I drive an EV. And hey, here's a quick plug. Max Patton does a great podcast called EV Politics on Apple. Check it out. Go to evpolitics.org. We got some fighting to do in Q1. Save American auto jobs in places like Michigan and Georgia. We will be back. Axe is on sick leave. He's doing fine. Had a little orthopedic repair done. So look out, Senior American Dance Contest coming up. But we'll get him back soon. And you all, I think we have one more before the holidays, right? I think so. We got to get the authorities in here to tell us. And I'm going to finish.
I mean, it's only December 10th, for God's sake. So the holidays are still, it seems like a million years away. But maybe they'll be here before we know it. Who knows?
I want to send one sobering message as the world gets wet, but it's somebody Jesus. I care about. We have a friend of the show, longtime listener, a smart, bright, just wonderful kid named Rafi, who a year ago was listening to Hacks on Tap and sending ideas. He's now wearing a uniform, carrying a rifle in the IDF in Lebanon, and hopefully he's coming home soon. So take care, Rafi. Be safe. With that, I call for peace on earth and an end to this blab fest here. Johnny Anzalone, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thanks, brother.
Always good.
It's a great American. You guys are both great Americans. That's just the truth. Yeah. You know?
We're great Michiganders. We're working on being great Americans.
Go fix your parties, you guys. Just go take care of it, okay?
My party, I don't have a wrench big enough, but we're trying. Okay. Anyway, right. Thank you, everybody.
Later, guys. Bye.
Have a great holiday season. Bye-bye.